Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work. People who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Lauren MacArthur with Arabella Advisors, and I'm so excited to be the host of this episode. We are living in a period of extraordinary threats and challenges. The pandemic, climate change, the threats to democracy and the global order, the breakdown of social cohesion and rise of political violence. These are urgent issues that threaten the foundations of human health and society. As we reflect on how philanthropy can best respond to these challenges and how it must change and adapt, are there lessons we can learn from history and how philanthropists responded to past crises? Ben Soskis is an historian, journalist, and scholar of philanthropy who serves as a senior research associate in the Center on Nonprofits and Philanthropy at the Urban Institute. He is also the co-editor of HistPhil, a web publication devoted to the history of the nonprofit and philanthropic sectors. He joins us today to help us make sense of the past and to explore whether it offers us any lessons we might bring to the current moment. We spoke together via Zoom, and I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed having the conversation with Ben. Ben, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to dig into this conversation with you. I want to start by getting your thoughts on the uses and value of understanding the history of philanthropy as we are in a moment which seems to promise a lot of uncertainty, dislocation, and crises in the future. What is the benefit and value of thinking about that history and the history of philanthropy can offer?
Yeah, great question. And it's great to be here. I want to start in answering that question by just noting a kind of paradox, which is when you are living in times that are kind of most frequently thought of as unprecedented, that happens to be the moment when people have the strongest urge to search for precedents. And I think there's, you know, a very understandable reason for that. There is a kind of comfort and a kind of urge to learn and to think about how other people have undergone crises. And so, you know, it's not surprising that in a moment like the one we're living in, where I think it's just defined by the sense of an entanglement in a whole host of crises, that a kind of historical turn has been, I think, prominent and really healthy for a lot of our thinking about the social sector and philanthropy. So, you know, what can it actually offer for people who are working in the sector? The one thing I always kind of caution about is I don't think that history offers a kind of neat collection of bullet points that are, you know, sort of extractable and can be easily applied to the current situation. And then that I think stems from another paradox, which is almost by definition, the more you learn about the past, the more you appreciate how it is distinct from the present moment. And so you always are dealing with a different period. And I think it's important to kind of appreciate that. On the other hand, I think appreciating the past, understanding historical trends, understanding the processes by which social change has happened, can really give you a sort of richness and an appreciation, a kind of humanistic appreciation of the work that we're all engaged in. It's something that I think just enriches people's understanding, and it's kind of a prerequisite for a sort of a deep appreciation of the complexities of any given moment. I think the other thing that really helps figure out, this is again maybe a little bit paradoxical for a historian to be kind of claiming, is that it really helps us think about novelty. Every claim of novelty is a historical claim. Every claim of novelty requires you to make some sort of claim about what's come before. And you can't claim that something is new if you don't understand what's happened in the past. And understanding what's new is, I think, crucial for anybody in the sector. And so appreciating the past helps us understand you know, both the continuities in the past, but also the discontinuities. And it's precisely at those discontinuities, the places where things are changing in dramatic and profound ways, that I think, you know, a lot of our attention should be focused. And those are, I think, types of understanding that history can have a really vital role in assisting.
Yeah, interesting. Well, recognizing that there is no real perfect precedent for the unprecedented moment that we're experiencing now, when I think about the crises we're facing, the scale of them, we've had a deadly pandemic we're still living with, we've had a climate and ecological crisis, crisis in democracy. The time that comes to mind for me when we faced large-scale crises is back, maybe World War II and back to the Great Depression. The Great Depression is an era that you've studied and you've looked into how philanthropists responded to that crisis. Can you talk a little bit about why that particular era and looking at that can be helpful or valuable? And then also just talk about, you know, how did charitable organizations and foundations and the social sector respond to the Great Depression?
Yeah, terrific. I mean, that was really where my, you know, when I was in that initial peak moment of the pandemic, that's really where my thoughts turned to. And there's a couple of reasons. I think kind of most powerfully, and it's something I think we're still struggling with, there was a sense of the kind of indeterminate timeline of the crisis. It's just, we didn't really know, and maybe still don't really know, whether we were in the beginning, middle, or end. And that was something that people in the Great Depression struggled with as well, and especially people who were engaged in charitable and philanthropic work. The other major element was just precisely as you introduced it, this sense of not being one crisis, but a kind of concatenation or tangle of different crises feeding into each other. In the Great Depression, that was ecological, it was economic, it was political. And so the sense that you couldn't really just address one element of society, but there was something much larger and broader that a kind of problem that afflicted society in a much broader way. There was also the sense, you know, unlike some natural disasters or other kind of localized crises, the profound sense that almost everybody was affected by this, and that everyone could also help address it. That was incredibly profound at the beginning of the pandemic for me and for many other people. But it also defined the ways people thought about the depression. And finally, I think one of the big elements of depression that we also struggle with now is just figuring out how to grapple with this tension or this tug between addressing immediate needs and thinking about longer term structural change. That was the key moment when the charitable sector and foundations really had to engage that tension. Was at the first real moment was at the Great Depression, and it's a tension that's really defined the charity and philanthropy ever since. So how did they respond? I think the most interesting thing is especially given kind of how the Great Depression fits into kind of narratives of charitable giving broadly conceived, there was a huge and incredibly impressive voluntarist surge in the early days of the Depression. It was, you know, both informal and formal churches, mutual aid, soup kitchens, person-to-person giving. In American thought, charitable giving, even though we think of ourselves as this incredibly charitable population, there's always been a really profound stigma on receiving charity. And the Depression was one of the periods when that stigma disappeared a bit. And that's why I think it's really important in American memory to kind of hold on to that. But it's also really key because, fundamentally what people learned is that as impressive as that kind of outpouring of charitable giving was, it just wasn't enough. It wasn't adequate. And so it's this moment when we appreciate that that a kind of celebration of the capacities of American generosity are entirely consistent with an appreciation, of the inadequacies of private giving, that those two things can completely coexist. And that, I think, is incredibly important for us to hold in our minds now. The other really important dimension of the Depression is that it was a moment for some really interesting experiments in public-private partnerships. You know, we might think these are new or kind of a new phenomena, but the ways in which private citizens initially really wanted to fund public relief and initially channeled a lot of their giving towards public aid agencies and local governments was you know, established some really fascinating precedents that I think, you know, are still valuable today.
Yeah. You know, one of the things in reading some of the history of this era, and as you alluded to, is that the Great Depression really showed the limits of voluntarism and mutual aid and reinforced the need for government. I think we saw that also in the pandemic, right? Like early in the pandemic, we were being asked to like make your own masks, right? And hospitals didn't have personal protective equipment and masks, and people were trying to, you know, collect people's masks and deliver it. And it was just very clear that government needed to come in and ensure the production of these materials, provide, you know, what it turned out to be trillions of dollars in support, economic support for families and businesses. Can you talk about it during the Depression, how philanthropy worked with government to support as government began to expand its role in addressing the fallout and the hardship of the economic hardship of the Great Depression? What are some of the ways or some examples of how philanthropy supported government that we might learn from?
Great topic. I want to just mark one thing before I talk about the specifics about philanthropy. And that's that it might seem natural to us now that leaders of the charitable sector are some of the most, you know, engage champions of a robust welfare state. And I think that's something that we can all recognize around us. But that was not always the case. In fact, for, you know, many of the early decades of the 20th century, there was a really hardcore territorialism and a kind of battle between a kind of progressive public policy advocates and the leaders of charitable agencies, a kind of struggle for who would get to kind of carry the load. And the Depression is a landmark in that it was the moment when the leaders of charity kind of let go of this this myth, really, that that voluntarism could be sufficient. And it marked the point at which the major leaders of charities became champions of a strong federal response. And that happened, I think, with philanthropy as well. I mean, philanthropy, especially, you know, some of the big foundations like Rockefeller, they always saw themselves as partners with with government. Early in the 20th century, one of the main models that they kind of conceptualized was a demonstration project where they would kind of prove the worth of different programs, and then they would kind of hand it off to either state or federal government. So they had this model intact, but the Depression offered a stage, a much more impressive stage in which to do that. Especially as it related to research and data, because, you know, at this moment, one of the preferred modes of foundation operation was to be, you know, kind of somewhat detached from the political arena and instead to offer kind of disinterested expertise on different realms. And they were able to do that in the Depression. I mean, the best example is the Russell Sage Foundation, which had done a lot of work before the Depression on relief practices. And so was just really well positioned once the Depression hit to be of enormous assistance to both state and federal agencies. And, you know, in some cases, they literally just handed it, they were a kind of operating foundation back then. And so handed over almost whole departments to governments to allow them to do a lot of the work for the administration of relief. They did, you know, important research that convinced state governments to kind of abandon some of the in-kind aid that they were giving and really to shift towards cash relief, you know, the kind of letting go of the bread line as a model. And they helped standardize many of the relief forms that made the administration of relief kind of more easy to manage. So, I mean, I think one lesson there is that in a crisis, it helps if you have already been doing the work before the crisis, you know, and that it's very hard to scale up in the midst of a crisis, but foundations that have been kind of planning and thinking can, you know, can really take enormous roles once the crisis begins.
Yeah. So I think if you look at the Depression, on the one hand, you had this charitable response to provide direct relief to folks. There was also this recognition that the scale and the magnitude of the earthquake, this economic earthquake, was beyond the capacity of charity and the social sector to resolve, and the need, the validation of the role for government. And you had some foundations working to support the implementation of these new welfare programs, right? Providing technical support, data. Those are all different ways that, different roles for philanthropy to play in a crisis. I think the other thing that I think about are social movements. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, you were saying, well, this period sort of validated the role of the welfare state. But I think that idea is still contested now, right? You have at least a segment of philanthropists that are, you know, not as interested in supporting, that are more focused on the role of private markets and reducing the role of government. And so for a lot of our problems, though, I think part of the issue is building public will and political consensus for transformative policy change. Think of something like climate change, right? And you have powerful forces that are opposed to maybe the changes that need to be made. And so that points to the importance of social movements to be able to shift power and build public will for robust government action on some of these big crises, again, like climate change. So I'm wondering if you can, and what you've written about the Depression is that philanthropy didn't necessarily play a huge role in supporting popular movements at the time. I think maybe in other periods, philanthropy did engage more with social movements, but would love for you to offer some perspective on how has philanthropy supported movements in the past, and what are some of the lessons, important lessons we can bring from that work?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you're right that the Depression was not a moment at which philanthropy was like deeply engaged in movement building work, though there were some exceptions. I mean, Mary Van Cleek at Russell Sage was a radical and had a vision of social policy that was deeply embedded in the labor movement, and so, you know, there were some kind of alternative possibilities of where philanthropy could have gone if her approach had been taken up, but for the most part. The Depression was, you know, kind of a key founding moment in this technocratic approach to philanthropy. It validated that approach, if anything, which sort of dissuaded philanthropy from supporting movements, and suggested that its place was, again, a kind of political remove, and that really didn't change much till the 50s and 60s, with some early support for the civil rights movement, you know, most notably with the Ford Foundation. I think there's been some very good work about that support for social movements that has, I think, historical work, but work that's very much speaking to the current moment as well, from scholars like Macon Ming Francis and others who have looked at that support and studied the ways in which it moderated and warped movements in more moderate directions, in directions that, that were safer and less of a threat to the status quo. And so that model, I mean, has been, you know, the shift from a kind of technocratic approach to a kind of liberal approach that that saw the role of philanthropy as sort of mediating between kind of social movements and, say, the establishment, was really the dominant approach for much of the 20th century. I think one thing that's happened recently is that philanthropy itself has really changed. That kind of technocratic approach and that approach, that kind of mediating approach, was especially powerful when there was a single philanthropic establishment, right? A single kind of liberal philanthropic establishment. But that establishment has fractured, and there are so many different kind of centers of power with often quite different political positionings on the spectrum. And so I think it allows for funders to engage movements, again, across the spectrum. And I think we're seeing more of that. And with that kind of cautionary tale about, how much is philanthropy supporting movements, and how much is philanthropy trying to control movements? This is a subject of lots of debate. I think it's quite possible for philanthropy to support movements in a healthy kind of modest way without kind of asserting its own prerogatives. I think, it's happens to be probably rarer than a lot of folks would like. But I think the lesson there, and I've done some work studying, for instance, the role of philanthropy in the passage of healthcare reform, and which was heavily dependent on kind of progressive movements, and I think the lesson there is weirdly kind of echoes one of the lessons of the Depression with the kind of technocratic assistance. It is really hard to be of service when the streets are already crowded. The work that philanthropy has to do has to come before that. It has to be a work of supporting a kind of patient community organizing that sets the ground for the moment when the crowds mobilize, when the windows open, and there's the kind of possibilities are really much more alive. But it's especially when the healthcare reform research I did, I was struck by, Atlantic Philanthropies was the main funder of healthcare reform, and it provided really crucial support in the kind of home stretch. But there was also a lot of quieter work that happened even before that at local levels across the country, so that when the time came, there were movements on the ground that could be mobilized. And I think that's, that's a lesson that history can give to foundations and philanthropists, that that the movement work should be long-term. It should be focused on, building up a really deep community-centered approach. And the other thing, which just I'll throw out, is I am really interested now in the kind of fraught, but I think really important connection between philanthropy and the labor movement, a subject for maybe a whole other conversation, but there's a really tangled, complicated history there, enormous possibilities, I think, for movement building.
Yeah, it's a really complex subject. I mean, I think that philanthropy isn't necessarily built to support. There's an extra institutional character to movements, right? Which makes it very difficult for philanthropy to support, right? Philanthropy is used to doing an RFP and supporting an organization that has a budget. And, that the nature of movements is they're working with established institutions, but there's also unaffiliated leadership that's emerging in these movement moments. And so, so I think part of it may be, what is the infrastructure that connects to movements and enables movements to channel the energy and power into concrete kind of policy efforts and policy change? But a very complex, and then the other trend maybe we're seeing that people have talked about is that and that I worry about is there some sort of crowd out happening where so many there's so much philanthropic capital. And in some ways, as philanthropy becomes more interested in supporting movements, the idea of building up your like a membership base and collecting dues, like that whole structure of membership organizations that were more grounded and accountable to members, I think is dissipated to some to some extent. And so you have less, you have more organizations that can fund their work by going to a few philanthropies or foundations, and that we've lost, there's been sort of a hollowing out maybe of organizing or movements or in that sense.
That is a really important point. It's one I think that I'm hearing from across, across the board. It is a point, famously the Harvard professor Theda Skocpol has made about, the kind of shift from a membership to a kind of fundraising ethos. I think it reflects, I think, an ambivalence now, with there was a moment at which there was a strong push for foundations to be more involved with public policy, with and with movements. And I think there is a sense that people are trying to think about what is the right relationship between funding and movement work. The kind of apparatus and the bureaucracies that can develop around them. I think it's again probably we could have a whole other discussion about this. The one thing I'll say is I am noticing that type of critique occurring in really interesting ways across the ideological spectrum. It is just interesting the ways in which the concerns about the the kind of nonprofit industrial complex, which you associate with a kind of a leftist critique, has been echoed among centrists and among people on the right, and so I think that is a sign of some larger kind of public ambivalence or discontent with the kind of civic landscape now. That's exactly the moments, I think, at which some of these powerful movements have an opportunity to kind of assert themselves. So I don't know if there's a historical precedent for this, but when you see that kind of convergence of critiques, it's often a sign that, that there's a real moment of possibility.
Yeah. Going back to the Great Depression, the other thing that I found interesting in reading some of your research into the Great Depression is that a number of foundations didn't really significantly shift their priorities in response to the Great Depression. And I think there's this tension when there's a crisis, do we pivot and throw resources into crisis response versus we have an important role to play in maintaining continuity and supporting our existing priorities. And I'm wondering what reflections you have about philanthropy during that period and the tension or the debate around whether to shift priorities. As I think about the current moment and you look at something like the climate crisis, the scientists are saying, you've got 10 years, this is existential. And yet, if you look at where the money is going, we're still putting more money into arts and culture than climate. And I don't want to be a Philistine and say that arts and culture isn't important. But as I look at this, I feel like there's a need for philanthropy to shift. My sense is that it's hard to do that, right? Because you have constituencies, you have program officers, you have grantees that are relying on philanthropy. And so I think there's a certain inertia. So I'm just curious, any reflections during that period of the push and pull within philanthropy about shifting priorities.
Played out. That's great. I mean, I think that the inertia that you're talking about is probably the most powerful force, and I don't want to like belittle that. It's really hard to ever tell anyone that you're not going to fund their work anymore. It's hard for the people funding it. It's hard for people that had been funded. But that being said, this is the thing I was most struck by when I looked at philanthropy during the Depression, and that is the sense for many of the scholars who've followed it most closely that foundation policies and practices just didn't change in profound ways, and that there was a consciousness of not changing, almost a kind of determination not to be changed by the crisis. And I think it stems from a really a kind of problematic temporal orientation that is embedded in philanthropy, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a sec. Deeply ingrained in the way that philanthropy has come to think of itself is the sense that it is engaged in thinking about the long run. That its view, that its scope is broad, is temporally broad. That charity, is focused on immediate needs, but philanthropy takes a long view. And the long view is always associated with the root causes, with structural change, with large societal transformations. And the short term is almost always associated with, the palliative, the easy fixes, the band-aid, so to speak. And I think there's ways in which that makes sense. Yeah, I think we can all kind of think about ways in which it is that could be the case. But I think that the kind of rigidity, which with philanthropists back then and even today, hold on to that view, can blind us to the ways in which the short term and engaging with immediate needs can often be the kind of entranceway to profound structural change. So it's not always the long term that's associated with transformation. Sometimes it's the short term, and a kind of short term focus that can provide that. And what was clear to me is that foundations back in the Depression really struggled with that. They felt some responsibility to address the immediate needs of the Depression, but they really wanted to focus on the long term. And I think they missed an opportunity. They missed an opportunity to think about how can you harness those needs in the moment, and what kind of doors does it open? What kind of potentials does it open in the present? How fluid are things when in the course of an immediate crisis? And so I think there's probably a combination between the kind of practical considerations that you're talking about and some of these like much deeper, almost like primordial philanthropic, beliefs that make folks concerned about taking their eyes off the long view.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the theme of some of the conversations we're having now is from crisis to opportunity, right? Or was it Churchill who said, never waste a good crisis?
If he didn't, he should have. I don't know. Yeah.
If you look at the Great Depression, the immediate created, I think, the modern welfare state in the United States. And so there is a way in which if we don't address these things in the short term, I think of it as there is no long term if we don't. But also, what are the opportunities presented by these crises to push for more transformational changes, to rethink our institutions and redesign our institutions so they're more equitable, they're more resilient, and that requires some shifting.
And I think there's some really interesting thinking about what is the relationship between short-term relief and longer-term structural change. I mean, one of the really striking things that a lot of foundations did during the pandemic is that they committed to direct cash relief, something that was many of them had no background to do before. I think the ways in which the kind of close engagement with people and with their needs you know, opens up possibilities for a movement building, for a whole other, you know, for lots of other work. So that this like strict tension between the short term and the long term, between the relief of immediate needs and structural change, I think the pandemic has kind of narrowed that divide a little bit in some really interesting ways. That's something that I'm fascinated to see what happens, you know, in the coming years, whether or not that some of that work continues, or you know, or if it's kind of relegated to a kind of crisis mindset.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.